Good afternoon, everybody. I like to call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:31 p.m. on Tuesday, February 28, 2023. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. members today in attendance are Senator Kaufman, Senator Dunbar, Senator Geisel, myself, Senator Wilson. Senator Tobin is on other state business, presented the bill in committee, and we expect her to join us later. But we do have a quorum to conduct business. Today we have three items on the agenda. First, we'll return to Senate Bill 53, five-year involuntary commitment. We heard an introduction to public and invited testimony on this bill on February 21st. And as we just ran out of time, and we'll finish that to have a few final comments from the bill sponsor and to see if there's any other questions from committee members. Bill sponsor can please come forth and get ready to get situated. Also on the phone to answer any questions is Dr. Christy Becker, the Chief Clinical Officer at our Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Department of Family and Community Services. Also, I believe Mr. Skidmore is on the phone. In fact, we only have Dr. Skidmore, not Dr. We have the Deputy Attorney General, John Skidmore, on the phone from the Department of Law. At this time, are there any questions from committee members? I know that the bill sponsor has a couple of changes that he's been walking around and talking to. And if Senator Klayman, if you can put yourself on the record and talk about some of those questions and issues. And we do have an amendment deadline for the bill, I think, later on tomorrow, 5 p.m.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Matt Klayman, Senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage. Our office is suggesting changes to Senate Bill 53, and I'm going to have my staff, Emma Potter, review those with the committee.
Ms. Potter?
For the record, this is Emma Potter, staff to Senator Klayman. I'm going to walk through an explanation of proposed changes from our office to Senate Bill 53. We are suggesting adding the crime of arson to the legislation. This change reflects suggestions our office received from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. It is their belief that including the felony offense of arson in addition to a felony offense against the person is necessary for public safety. The suggested change includes conforming changes in Section 1, Section 2, and Section 4 of the legislation. There are two suggested changes to Section 4 of the legislation. The first change is the removal of the word repeated from Section 4, Line 8. It is our intention that the provisions outlined in the legislation apply upon a person's first dismissal of a felony level offense against a person. The second change modifies Section 4, Subsection E. This subsection relates to the ability of individuals to petition for early release. The suggested change is to create a one-year limit on a new petition from the individual, both after the initial order for involuntary commitment up to 5 years, and a subsequent denial of a petition for early release. There are three suggested changes in AS 1247-100. The first change is to add a requirement that requests for competency evaluation in AS 1247-100 to be written requests. The second change allows the court to order defendants evaluated for competency at outpatient facilities while on bail. The third change states that when the psychiatrist or psychologist finds that the defendant is incompetent and the defendant is charged with a felony offense against the person or arson, the psychiatrist or psychologist may evaluate the defendant for involuntary commitment. The fourth change allows the court to order defendants treated for competency restoration at outpatient facilities on bail. Other changes to Title 12 include increasing the maximum time a person can be held for restoration to competency from 1 year to 2 years, adding language that if the court dismisses the charges against a defendant for incompetency for a felony offense against a person or arson, the defendant may not be discharged until 72 hours after the court dismisses the charges. This is meant to allow time for the civil commitment petition to be filed. And the final change for Title 12 is changing the number of evaluations by a psychiatrist or psychologist from 2 to 1 for the insanity defense. This will match the number of evaluations required for the insanity defense to the number of evaluations required in the process for both the evaluation for competency and involuntary commitment. And the final group of changes to the legislation that we are proposing addresses alleged victim notice in a specific instance where an individual is found incompetent to stand trial and related felony level offenses against the person or arson are dismissed. The current version of the bill creates a duty for the Department of Law to file a civil commitment petition upon the dismissal of felony-level offenses against the person based on an incompetency finding. The first change is a process change and would require the Criminal Division to notify the Civil Division of the Department of Law within 24 hours of charges being dismissed in the situation that the bill addresses. The second change is also a process change and states that the civil division shall file a petition for involuntary commitment within 72 hours of the dismissal of charges in the situation that the bill addresses. The third change is creating a right for the alleged victim and the dismissed criminal charges to receive notice of the time and place of any civil commitment proceeding, of the court's finding at any civil commitment proceeding, including the length of time for which the respondent is committed, and of when the respondent is discharged from any civil commitment. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions on the list of changes? Dr. Senator Giesel.
Thank you. And I may have missed this, but in the bill on page 2, line 12, the word repeated also appears. Is that being removed? You took it out of page 3, line 8.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, it's our intent that all the references to repeated would be removed. If we may have missed one in our description, that doesn't reflect our desire to remove the repeated reference.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Right, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Dunbar.
So one broader question than one pretty specific. So it's clear that you've sort of gone through this iterative process back and forth with the Department of Law, and the criminal division in particular has made specific requests, and you've honored some of those. I think we all received a letter from the Disability Law Center that also made some pretty specific requests and the sort of broader constitutional challenge. But have you engaged with that back and forth process with them? Are you willing to entertain some of their notional changes to this?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I'm always happy to talk with Disability Law Center. They actually haven't scheduled time with us. We can try to contact them as we move forward. We have worked with them successfully on other legislation in the past, and so I think some of the concerns that they raise, I'm not sure they read the bill. I'm not sure I wholly agree with their reading of the bill in different instances, and I know part of their objection is, in broad terms, they don't like the five-year commitment.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any way to, other than not do the bill at all and go back to just having a six-month commitment process, I'm not sure they'll ever be satisfied with what we're proposing. But I'm more than happy to talk with them and we'll be happy to do that.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
for you, Mr. Chair, before I ask my other question? So I'm still learning about the CS process. So these amendments, we are not voting on these amendments today. Is that correct? We're expecting another version of this bill soon?
Yes, I just wanted to have an opportunity. We ran out of time to talk about some of the changes and issues with the bill.
Okay.
Allow the sponsor to talk about some of the changes, just to hear some committee feedback and make sure that their committees are okay with some of these changes before we order a CS.
Okay. Then may I continue, Mr.
Yes.
Chair? So I am not comfortable with – we spoke about this before. I don't think I'm comfortable with adding arson. And it's not because arson isn't a terrible and dangerous crime, but this is a novel – as we talked about the last committee, we might be the first state to ever do this process in this way, correct? And it's novel, and it's in response to a terrible tragedy that occurred. And I think we want to be as narrowly focused when we're changing the criminal law to that set of circumstances as possible. And I can see the justification from the criminal division's perspective. You know, this is also a really dangerous crime, but so is drunk driving. And I would guess that probably more people are killed on average by drunk drivers in Alaska every year than arsonists. I don't know that for sure. And certainly most drunk driving doesn't result in death. But, you know, once you open this up to beyond just crimes that are specifically against a person, I think there are a variety of crimes that might eventually fall into that category of, you know, dangerous. And so, again, I don't think I am comfortable with adding arson at this time, but maybe there's enough votes to, you know, where that is what it is.
Well, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the question about arson and how that compares to other felony crimes against the person, which was the bill started out just with the felony crimes against the person, I think that's a useful, not just a useful, but a meaningful question, and I appreciate it. I think as a starting point, I don't view this legislation as one that suddenly creates this massive number of people that are going to fall into what I think is a very narrow focus of folks that A, are incompetent, B, non-restorable, and C, hit a certain level of dangerousness. And I don't think there's any history, for example, of DWI, even felony DWI is one where we're seeing a whole raft of folks that hit the first two tests of incompetence and non-restorable in that mix. But in terms of why arson should be, felony arson should be added with the other felony crimes against the person in Title 41, Title 11, Chapter 41, I would actually, since he's on the phone, I would ask the chair to call on Mr. Skidmore to provide his perspective on why he sees arson as comparable, because I think he's got a little more, he may be able to give more perspective on that than I can offer.
Yes. Mr. Skidmore, are you with us?
Good afternoon, I am.
Did you hear the question and comments from Senator Dunbar and from Senator Klayman?
For the record, this is John Skidmore, the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, the reason that arson is included is because the elements of the crime of arson, particularly arson in the first degree, require another person to actually be harmed or at risk of being harmed. So it truly does fit that same element of a person physically being harmed as opposed to property issues or drug issues or something of that nature. And while I appreciate that for the example you use of a DUI, we wouldn't want to take these same steps simply for somebody that had been facing a DUI. But in that DUI, if they were in an accident and someone had been injured, then there would also be an assault charge, which would be a felony crime against the person, and then you do have that same conduct grouped with these other types that are listed here. Beyond that, what I would tell you is that from my 25 years of practice, the most serious cases that we see, the homicides, the sexual assaults, and I would group arson with that for the individuals that end up having mental health issues, they pose the greatest danger and risk to the public when they are released, because those are the types of conduct that pose the greatest danger to other members of the public. So that was the rationale for us to propose arson to be included with it. We, of course, understand that this is ultimately a policy call for the legislature to make.
Thank you. Just follow up, Senator Dunbar, and then we'll go to Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So sort of two thoughts on that. The first is, so what you're saying is that this satisfies the, because it's this sort of first degree or certain type of felony arson that satisfies similar elements to a crime against a person, but for some reason isn't categorized as a crime against a person. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, arson is actually characterized or codified in Alaska Statute 11 and Chapter 46, which are really property offenses. But what I am telling you is that the elements for arson involve that danger or risk of danger to other persons, which separates it from the type of conduct that you see in most property crimes. And it's that rationale, the fact that setting fire to a structure places other human beings at risk of physical harm, that's why it makes sense from a policy perspective to group it in this particular proposal with those other crimes against a person. That would be the department's position. Again, I acknowledge this is a policy call and the legislature gets to make those sorts of policies.
So one quick one. Okay, so actually it's kind of two. Do they have to have knowledge the person is in the building for this kind of felony assault, for this kind of felony? And then second, you know, for example, the governor right now is seeking additional penalties for fentanyl distribution, for example. Not a crime against a person, but categorizing it as one of the most dangerous crimes out there and very likely to result in death of perhaps many people for that kind of drug distribution. Why is this crime worse than that crime, I guess is my question, if we're going to narrowly cabinet in this way?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, to answer the first question you've asked me, the crime of arson does not require the arsonist to know that there is another person in the building. The It's just the nature of arson itself, that it poses a risk to others there. So it doesn't require that foreknowledge. To answer the second question you had, the governor's bill addressing penalties for fentanyl is really addressing manslaughter or homicide, which are 1141 crimes. And so that's really what it's focused on. And those crimes would also be included under the bill that's in front of you, SB 53, because they're crimes against a person. So I don't see simple distribution of drugs suddenly being something for which would be included in this bill. But when it causes the death of someone, there are already provisions in our crimes against persons that do apply.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I believe this is for Mr. Skidmore. Gosh, I'm not sure how to ask this. So we're dealing with kind of the strange fuzzy boundary of being able to operate with intent versus being incompetent to act with intent, I think. And I guess so I was trying to think of if driving under the influence, I don't know that could that happen because of incompetence? I guess it could. Arson, I guess that could happen without intent because someone is incompetent. So if you could, and again, I'm sorry for such a poorly formed thought, but I'm struggling with these concepts of being able to act with intent or not. Could you just speak to that a little bit as it might pertain to some of the topics? I can't imagine that somebody would be a drug dealer via mental incompetence. That would require a certain competence. But maybe driving or arson, not so much. Can you work with me on that?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, the bill that's in front of you is addressing when an individual has engaged in conduct that would be considered criminal, but for their inability to assist in their defense, which is the definition of incompetency. If they're unable to assist in that defense, then the person is attempted to be restored, and if that can't occur, then there are questions about whether or not the person meets the standards for civil commitment. So it's not about their ability to engage in the conduct. That's to take it to a baser level in any criminal act, any crime, there are two elements, the actus reus, the act, and the mens rea, which is the mental element. And when we talk about incompetency, it's the ability to assist counsel in defending against those accusations. But when you talk to me about intent, you're talking about the ability for somebody to decide they will commit a particular action. That's not necessarily what incompetency addresses. So there's a distinction between those two concepts. I hope that answer helps solve the problem that you're wondering about.
Yes, thank you. That was very helpful.
All right. Any other further questions for bill sponsor? Seeing none, we'll continue to work with the bill sponsor to get a CS before the committee. When that's ready, we'll bring this bill back up in front of the committee. I do know that there is an issue. I believe I have not seen the memo, but there might be a legal question and memo on the constitutionality. But we'll leave that for the next committee of referral to address, because that is the Judiciary Committee who would handle that, those questions, and see if they can find a fix for that situation. So at this time, we'll take an IDs to bring up the next bill presenter. We are back on the record. At this time, we have Senate Bill 51, Control Substance Data Exemption, Exempt Veterinarian, sponsored by Senator Tobin. She's away in other state business right now, but we do have her trusted staff, Mr. Trevor Bailey, here to at the testifier's table to present the bill and to walk through a sectional with us. Mr. Trevor, the bill's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. My name is Trevor Bailey, and I'm staff to Senator Tobin. As the chairman said, Senator Tobin is away on other state business doing a bill hearing in another committee. So fortunately, you guys get me. For the committee's knowledge, I will be providing the introduction and then going over the sectional and then passing it to the invited testifiers to do the presentation. So if you have any questions about the presentation or its contents, I would ask that you hold it until the invited testifiers are up. So on Senate Bill 51, in response to a nationwide opioid epidemic, the Alaska State Legislature created the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, otherwise known as the PDMP. The PDMP created a database of prescriptions for controlled substances in Alaska. Unfortunately, the program failed to account for major differences between the practice of human medicine and veterinary medicine. SB 51 addresses this conflict by exempting veterinarians from the prescription drug monitoring program. Eliminating the requirement for veterinarians in Alaska to be subject to the PDMP does not mean that veterinarians will be unregulated. Veterinarians will still be covered by federal statutes as well as monitoring by the Drug Enforcement Agency, or the DEA, and by the Board of Veterinary Examiners. Additionally, provisions in state statute will continue to limit the amount of opioids a veterinarian can prescribe to 7 days, with two exceptions. Prescription drug monitoring is not unique to Alaska. All 50 states have some variation of the PDMP, with over 30 states exempting veterinarians. Previously, 10 of those 30 states mandated veterinarians participate in their version of the PDMP, but later went back and exempted veterinarians. In Alaska, the PDMP fails to be effective with veterinarians because animal patients do not have identifiers like a social security number. As a result, veterinarians must try to get private health data of those who seek care for their animals prior to treating the animal. This is both inefficient and an invasion of privacy. Senate Bill 51 seeks to correct an overexpansion of the PDMP to ensure that all Alaskans have continued access to veterinary care. And now, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move on to the sectional analysis.
Please.
So Section 1 deletes the requirement that the Board of Veterinary Examiners notify the Board of Pharmacy when a practitioner registers with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Section 2 creates a new subsection in the Controlled Substance Substance Prescription Database statutes that exempts veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Section 3 repeals the subsection that requires veterinarians register with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. And Section 4 is that the act takes effect immediately upon passage. And if I may make one comment, Mr. Chair, I will say that an iteration of this legislation existed in the 32nd legislature. Although the legislation that you have before you today looks substantially different than what it was in the previous legislature, it still has the same legislative purpose and intent. Our legislative legal department decided to draft a bill in a more clear and succinct way, but it still meets the goal of the previous form of legislation.
Great. Thank you with that. Are there any questions on the sectional or the bill itself thus far? Seeing none, we'll bring up our invited testifiers at the time. We have Dr. Tracy Ward, the past president of the Alaska State Veterinarian Medical Association, and Rachel Berngart, the chair of the Board of Veterinarian Examiners, also here. And ladies, if you can just, when you go in between yourselves, just make sure you restate on the record who you are, just for clarification for records. It'd be wonderful. You may begin when you're ready.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L, last name is Berngart, B-E-R-N-G-A-R-T-T, and I'm a veterinarian and attorney, and I'm the chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dr. Tracy Ward. I am a veterinarian practicing at Juneau Animal Rescue here in town and the immediate past president of the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association, who I'm representing today. We're here to discuss Senate Bill 51, an act exempting veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. For the record, both the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association and the Alaska Board of Veterinary Examiners support this bill. As well, the agency that administers the PDMP, the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy, has voted on and passed a motion to support the exemption of veterinarians from this agency as well. A short background for those of you not familiar with the history. Alaska's PDMP was established in 2008, and for the first nearly 8 years was highly encouraged but voluntary participation. In 2016, in reaction to the growing opioid epidemic, the legislation took effect in 2017, but in 2016, H. Bill 159 amended the PDMP legislation to mandate participation by all federal drug enforcement agency participants, including veterinarians. It's important to note that the committee that was formed and the discussions around this amendment did not include either the AKVMA or the Board of Veterinary Examiners. It included the boards of all of the other medical and optometry, Board of Pharmacy, all the other boards that were required to participate, but veterinarians were not consulted or included. Regardless, the legislation was enacted in 2017 and is now mandatory for all actively licensed practitioners who hold a DEA license, who prescribe, administer, or dispense federally scheduled 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances. So we want to take a few minutes just to discuss why the PDMP is not an effective database for veterinarians or our patients and why the differences with the medical situation. Obviously, the PDMP was established for human medicine. And querying, as Mr. Bailey discussed, querying of the PDMP database for animals is not possible because they do not possess a unique identifier, such as a social security number. In fact, we often don't even know an animal's birth date, and their name and ownership can change throughout the course of their lives. So when a veterinarian is required to query the system, we query the individual who brings the patient to us, in other words, our client, not our patient. And we obtain human data and human medical history for the person that brought the animal to us. This data, unfortunately, is not something that we are able to accurately interpret because veterinarians are not trained in human pharmacology. We know from our experience with every other species that drug dosages and appropriate treatment can vary tremendously between species. So we don't really know when we look at our client's medical history if the prescriptions that they have been prescribed previously are appropriate in terms of dosing, length of time, or the frequency that the prescription is renewed. Essentially, the data that we are forced to look at is we are not able to interpret. So it essentially does not change what we are going to decide to prescribe for our patient, which is the animal. Conversely, when that data would be looked at by human medical personnel, they're in the same boat, not being able to interpret the meaningfulness of that information or whether or not the prescription that was provided for their pet is something that they should be concerned about because doctors aren't trained in human pharmacology. As we also mentioned in the sponsor statement, querying of the human PDMP information is problematic because it's an invasion of the individual's medical privacy. Veterinarians are not bound by HIPAA regulations in regard to our clients because they are not our patient. And I would ask the committee to kind of look at the names of some of these drugs that are listed at the bottom of this slide and ask yourself if you would like someone with whom you do not enjoy client-patient privilege to have access to that information. That is something that's very uncomfortable for veterinarians and for our clients. As was also discussed, veterinarians are monitored by the Drug Enforcement Agency and must adhere to strict controlled substance regulations. For those of you who aren't aware, there is a significant level of accountability, record keeping, and medication storage requirements that veterinarians, as any other medical practitioner, must adhere to when we're talking about controlled substances. In addition, distributors of controlled substances are required to monitor our use patterns. There is a suspicious order monitoring system in place that distribution companies of controlled substances are required by the DEA to monitor and report unusual purchase patterns that a veterinarian may have. So in other words, if a clinic or an individual veterinarian suddenly starts purchasing, or even not suddenly, over time, is purchasing controlled substances outside of what has historically been normal for that practice, or in comparison to similar practices of similar size and type, that those purchases are flagged and investigated. I have personal experience with this, having just a year ago started in a new practice that did not previously have controlled substances available and having to fill out extensive paperwork and follow up with the distributors about expected use patterns and filing additional paperwork when we realized we were going to be using more drugs than we had originally thought because we were doing more surgery, and that was a concern about being flagged and having to make sure that we were able to show legitimate use of those drugs. So there is definitely still oversight to help control and prevent diversion from licensed veterinarians to drug dealers or illicit users. At this point, I'm going to turn over to Dr. Berngard to give the licensing perspective.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Rachel Berngard. So 33 other states have already exempted veterinarians from participating in the PDMP, while the Board of Veterinary Examiners and the AKVMA recognizes that Alaska is unique in many ways. We're not asking to be the first in line here. There are a number of states, 10 of them to be exact, that previously required veterinary participation but have since exempted veterinarians. There's been enough time that has elapsed at this point that if those states or other states, the other 23 states to be specific, if they had begun seeing diversion from veterinarians that may have been captured by a prescription drug monitoring program, it makes sense that they would have required veterinarians to participate. So we're not asking Alaska to be the first one to exempt veterinarians. There's extensive information already available about why other states have elected to exempt veterinarians and that there has been no increase in diversion that would require prescription drug monitoring participation. So one really important thing to understand is that the drugs that are most often implicated in overdose and death are not drugs that are prescribed by veterinarians. On this chart in front of us, we see the trends in the U.S. drug overdose deaths. And this encompasses not just Alaska, but this is a United States drug overdose death. And what is missing from this slide is that, and I apologize, there's a typo that happened. Under the synthetic opioids, excluding methadone, overdose deaths have increased. It should be 97-fold. And when we think about what are those synthetic opioids that are increasing those deaths, they're most commonly fentanyl and oxycodone. Those are drugs that veterinarians simply do not prescribe for dispensing. There is very little use of veterinary fentanyl. If it is used at all, it is used in the hospital, and it's being given directly to the patient. It's not something that's being dispensed out. Oxycodone is not something that has veterinary usage. And so when we think about what drugs are causing the problems, it's important to remember that veterinarians do not prescribe those drugs. One number that is also important to look at is that, and this was based in a study that was done from 2017, which is still the most current data that we have, that only 0.34% of the total opiate prescriptions were opiate medications dispensed by veterinarians. One thing that is important to think about is that the prescription drug monitoring program is one tool in the toolbox. It is not the only tool in the toolbox. Veterinarians still have other tools to employ with regards to proper control of controlled medications, specifically opiates. There's a natural barrier to doctor shopping for vets, which is really what the prescription drug monitoring program is good at. It takes aggregate data from different practitioners, and for example, if you go to an emergency room, that emergency room will see you regardless of your ability to pay. So it is theoretically possible that someone who is drug seeking could go to an ER. They don't have to pay for drugs. They could say whatever it is that they need to say. They could go to a different ER the next week and those sorts of things. The prescription drug monitoring program is really good at catching that sort of behavior. The issue with veterinary medicine, though, and why there is that natural barrier, is that we require payment up front, and it's just that simple. If you can't pay for veterinary services, you're not going to get those advanced diagnostics that would even be required before a vet would be considering dispensing any sort of opiate. And then secondly, you're also not going to get perhaps the thing that you may be seeking. So while I would just say that somebody who's drug seeking, there is a lot of other options that do not involve veterinarians, and removing us from the prescription drug monitoring program, since we're not a source of doctor shopping already, that's not going to, or at least we do not expect it to have any meaningful impact as far as whether or not people would then start to doctor shop with veterinarians.
Before you go on to the next slide, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, one of the objections that I hear on this is that, well, it's in this case, it's 0.34%. So 0.34% is that somehow that will increase. We open the door to this. And I guess you just mentioned cost as being prohibitive, but would it be that hard for somebody to go around with, let's say, a little dog that was obviously in pain and maybe pay the bill in three or four locations to get an opioid that somehow matters to them? Is that even possible or likely?
Anything's possible, but I would have to say it's extremely unlikely for a number of reasons. The first is that given the current veterinary shortage, unless the animal were in an emergency situation, I know here in Juneau, people are waiting between 3 days and 2 weeks to get an animal into for a veterinary appointment, unless the animal is in a life-threatening situation. So there's the time delay. Once you arrive at the veterinary clinic with an obviously painful animal, depending on what was wrong with them, you would probably be looking at between $500 and $800 worth of diagnostics. If it were, say, someone had intentionally tried to break their dog's leg, X-rays, blood work, a physical exam. And then depending on the severity of the pain, again, as Dr. Bernhardt mentioned, we rarely reach for opioid drugs first. We use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs would be the primary go-to. If an animal was in the type of pain that would require an opioid, they would most likely be admitted to the hospital and be kept for observation and treatment in-house. I can count on one hand the number of times that I would have sent a patient home with something stronger than a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. So being able to take your animal in that much pain to three or four hospitals in a short time frame is virtually impossible.
Yes, follow up, but really on a kind of a different line of questioning, if I may. And we'll do so. The PDMP, that's one piece of it. Of what is prescribed, does the veterinarian typically act as the dispensary for that? So is there any kind of tracking issue that will break if we do this?
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Kaufman, I actually do have some licensing data to present a few slides ahead. Right now, currently, if memory serves me, we have approximately 60, that's 60 veterinarians who even directly dispense prescription controlled substances from their clinic. And so that doesn't mean that they don't use those drugs in-house and directly administer to the animal patient, but that they would potentially dispense those medications out directly.
And doctors, if you guys can just restate who you guys are for the record, that'd be wonderful.
I'm sorry, and through the chair to Senator Kaufman, that was Dr. Rachel Berngart responding to the question.
Thank you, and follow up on that. So what I was asking is, if veterinarians are dispensing this, a controlled substance of enough potency to be of interest to someone, but we don't have them in the PDMP in that function, is there any other control mechanism that tracks it? Is where what I'm trying to discern.
Sorry, I'm going to jump in for the record, Dr. Ward. So as Dr. Berngart mentioned, there are currently only 60 veterinarians in the state that dispense. The rest of us, which encompasses about another 350 licensed veterinarians, give or take, would send a written prescription to a pharmacy. So that is where the record keeping would take place, because we would not be dispensing the product directly. We'd be writing a prescription, and they would be accessing the drug through a pharmacy. Is that closer to what you're looking for?
Well, it's. I guess what I'm looking, is there a gap anywhere?
Okay.
Is there a gap created? So the PDMP is a form of reporting of prescribing and, I guess, dispensing. And so if there's those veterinarians that would write a prescription and it would get filled at the pharmacy, then there's a tracking system there. If they have it in stock and they're dispensing it, is there a gap there that somehow we're creating by the legislation?
Again, Dr. Tracy Ward, through the chair, so there is potentially a very small gap with those 60 doctors who prescribe, dispense. The vast majority of doctors who dispense would be dispensing Schedule 4 drugs, such as phenobarbital for seizure control. I am not aware of more than a handful of clinics that would dispense Schedule 2 drugs, the opioid class drugs. They almost always are either used in-house or would go through a pharmacy where that information would be available to the PDMP.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think going off of Senator Kaufman's question, imagine that the bad actor in the scenario is not a patient, but actually one of the veterinarians, one of the 60 veterinarians you described. Let's say they have either themselves or maybe someone in their family or someone maybe that is diverting. And so they are repeatedly filling and distributing these Schedule II opioids. Is there any, how would they get caught, basically? What would ping? Who would catch them?
Thank you. This is
before Senator Dunbar. I think it might be helpful to talk about, and maybe that can be. we do have a Sullivan Robb, the director, from the Division of Boards and Corporation Licensing, to talk about maybe the use of the PDMP, because DEA does not review the PDMP for sort of bad actors. It's not that that intent. So I'm sorry, if you can talk maybe how PDMP plays a part of how that's utilized for that, and who actually, if you can, if not, maybe Sullivan Robb. I'm sorry to interrupt Senator Dunbar's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, for the record, this is Rachel Berngart, through the chair to Senator Dunbar. So a veterinarian who is engaging in, we'll say, nefarious behavior with illicit either drug consumption or drug distribution, That is one thing that even currently, as the PDMP stands now, the PDMP cannot capture that behavior. A veterinarian who would be diverting drugs would not be entering those controlled substances in the prescription drug monitoring program. So to your second point, how do those veterinarians get caught? Usually it's on inventory, and again, I'm not aware of, so I've been on the board almost 8 years. I'm aware of one instance where there was an issue with a professional with a substance abuse problem, and they were caught through their DEA drug logs, essentially, and through their own practice and through the practice duplicity in compliance requirements.
Thank you. NSA is a co-sponsor of the bill. I think that's a very helpful answer. Thank you.
We can pick it up double time and let's get through.
Certainly. So quickly here, there have been a large increase in investigative costs that are passed directly onto the Board of Veterinary Examiners since veterinarians have been required to participate in the prescription drug monitoring program since 2018. We've had a pretty sharp increase in costs. Those investigative costs, while they have come down in 2022, which is great, and I can go into a little bit more detail if there's questions about why that may be. Ultimately, the take-home point from this slide is that investigative costs that are borne by the Board of Veterinary Examiners, those costs are passed along to licensees. We have the highest licensing fees in the United States for veterinarians. We have a severe veterinary shortage across the United States and particularly in Alaska. So when we look at what can we do to make Alaska look more hospitable to encouraging new practitioners, reduction in licensing fees is one of those ways. It's also important to note that while we've had all of these investigations and we've expended all of this financial effort, no identification of nefarious behavior with veterinarians has been found throughout the time veterinarians have been required to participate in the prescription drug monitoring program. I think I've pretty much covered what is on this slide already. And just as one other kind of licensing data point, currently right now we have 452 licensed veterinarians in the entire state. Not all of them may be practicing in the state. Only 351 of those vets currently have a DEA license. There are many vets who are involved in, we'll say, industry or maybe they work for the state. Their veterinarians all don't see just patients. They might be in food security. So there are a multitude of reasons why a veterinarian may not possess a DEA license. They simply don't need it in their practice. And we have about 272 licensed veterinary technicians. So just for the math on that, we don't even have one technician who could be a delegate per licensed veterinarian. So when we think about the veterinary shortage and kind of that bottleneck of even getting in to be seen, we have veterinarians who don't have the opportunity to even have a delegate, and they're spending time looking at this data because they're required to do so, and yet it's not changing their patient treatment protocol because we aren't trained to interpret that data. So on behalf of the Board of Veterinary Examiners and the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association, we're encouraging support for SB 5051. Will allow veterinarians to provide the appropriate, timely medical management for each patient. Will increase the efficiency of the PDMP and help with accurate data collection and interpretation of the trends in human medicine. Will allow for continued judicious use of controlled substances that is already being practiced by veterinarians, and will eliminate unnecessary and disproportionate business burdens for veterinarians. Thank you very much for your time and attention, and are there any further questions that we can answer?
Any further questions for our invited testifiers before we move on to public testimony? Seeing none, thank you, doctors, for your testimony this afternoon.
Thank you.
Now going to open up to public testimony. We have Susan Nolan from North Pole. If you can plan 2 minutes for your testimony, Susie, and then we'll move on to Melissa Rogue.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. My name is Susie Nolan. I am the practice manager of North Pole Veterinary Hospital up in North Pole. We are a very busy nine-doctor practice. And just kind of supporting all the statements that that the doctors presented earlier, the PDMP really does not work for animals without a permanent identifier, and the, you know, different birth dates depending on who brings them in. So being specific to an animal doesn't provide a benefit. The PDMP system is non-compatible with the veterinary profession, again, for all the reasons that were listed previously, and does place an undue burden on practicing veterinarians. There's veterinary shortages around the state and in both veterinarians and licensed veterinary technicians, so delegates wouldn't provide a benefit either. So I just ask for your support, and please vote yes on Senate Bill 51.
Thank you. Next, we have Melissa Rogue.
Hi, my name is Melissa Rouge. I'm a veterinarian at North Pole Vet Hospital, and I also work for the Fairbanks North Star Borough Animal Shelter. As a veterinarian, I have no interest in looking up the owner's information before I treat their pet. We do not dispense controlled substances two or three. And it doesn't really work for animals in the shelter. They don't have an owner. There's no one to look up. And like I said, I don't want to look up an owner because that's not my business. And a lot of times the kid brings the dog in, or they can have one day the dog is fluffy, and then the next day someone else brings it in and it's snowball. There's no way for me to prove that that's the same dog or a different dog.
All right. Well, thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
See no one else for online testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau would like to testify on Senate Bill 51? Seeing none, we will go ahead and close testimony. Let folks know that may be listening online. If you'd like to submit written testimony, feel free to do so to the Senate Test Committee at shss.akleg.gov. And would the bill sponsor like to make any closing comments? Seeing none, are there any questions? Last questions for committee members? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside and bring it back at a later date. We'll set an amendment deadline for this piece of legislation for March 5th, Monday, March 5th, at close of business at 5 p.m. March 6th. At this time, we'll take an IDs and bring our last piece of business item, Senate Bill 59, before us. We are back on the record. The last item on our agenda this afternoon is Senate Bill 59, Runaways, for Department of Community and Family Services, Department of Health, Duties, Licensing, and Info, which is sponsored by the request of Senate Rules, request of the Governor. Here at the table, we have Heather Carpenter, the Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department. Also, we have the Deputy Commissioner, Clinton Lasley, here from the Department of Department of Community and Family Services, and Heather Carpenter is with the Department of Health. We have a tag team approach, so if you guys are ready, please put yourselves on the record and please begin.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health, Healthcare Policy Advisor.
Thank you. For the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services.
And again, this is Heather Carpenter for the record. Just a little bit of quick history to set the stage for this bill. In 2021, the governor had introduced Executive Order 119 that was proposed to split the Department of Health and Social Services into two departments, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. I am sure Chair Wilson remembers that we had to pull that executive order due to some drafting errors and some changes that were considered substantive in nature, which went too far from the powers of an executive order. So Governor Dunleavy reintroduced the executive order last legislative session as Executive Order 121, and that executive order was adopted and took effect July 1st of 2022, splitting the Department of Health and Social Services into two. And I will pass it off to Deputy Commissioner Lasley.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Family and Community Services. As Ms. Carpenter mentioned, when we went through the process of Executive Order 121, we knew at that time that there would be some additional changes, those especially that were substantive. And as we went through this large piece of legislation, we knew that there would be some other amendments or changes that may need to be made. So that's what we're bringing forward to you today in SB 59. I'm going to do a quick overview of what we're hoping to accomplish with this bill, and then I'll pass it back over to Ms. Carpenter to do the sectional analysis of this bill. This bill ensures that the new Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services share important information, including confidential protected health information, as necessary to administer programs within each department to serve Alaskans. I would say what we're doing with this is providing in statute just the clarity of work that we've already been doing when we're the Department of Health and Social Services, now making sure that that's clarified and outlined in the statute so that we can continue to serve Alaskans to the best of our ability without barriers. And there's many ways in which we do this on a daily basis and making sure that we're receiving eligibility for an individual, that maybe that part would lie on the Department of Health with the DPA, and I'm working with a child in Office of Children's Services, or looking at licensing of facilities, which also for Medicaid facilities, which lies in the Department of Health, and making sure that I can get a facility licensed for a complex youth. So this is a very important piece of this bill. We also add the Commissioner of the Department of Family and Community Services to be an advisor to the trustees of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This was something that we knew that needed to be done in a cleanup bill because it was a substantive change. We have had conversations with the Mental Health Trust and they're in support of this. And clarifying statutes related to licensing duties assigned to the former Department of Health and Social Services. Licensing is related to runaway shelters and foster homes. While the foster home licensing is should be in the Department of Family and Community Services, and the runaway shelters should be in the Department of Health. That was just a citation error that needed to be corrected. And then finally, there is a small amendment that was attached in AS 1865-340. It defines the department to include the Department of Family and Community Services. Currently, it lists out the Department of Health, but the Department of Family and Community Services is identified in definition as a department. And with that, Ms. Carpenter.
And for the record, Heather Carpenter, Chair Wilson, I'd be happy to walk through a quick sectional analysis if you would like.
Yes, please.
All right. Section 1 is amending. It's a technical change, correcting a mistake in the executive order, and it's amending AS 1262-400. That's part of the National Criminal History Records that we have to check for employment and licensing. And this is actually resides with the Department of Public Safety. So that's why we're touching criminal statutes, but it's something that healthcare services, our background check unit, sends fingerprints over on behalf. And so on page 3, lines 27 to 29, we're removing runaway shelters to make that citation more precise. That's part of that cleanup because it's done by the Department of Health. And runaway shelters are licensed through, like I said, Department of Health, healthcare services, residential licensing. Section 2 is the piece that's adding the Department of Family and Community Services Commissioner as a statutory advisor to the Mental Health Trust. Just for the record, the other advisors are the Commissioner of Health, Revenue, and DNR. Section 3 is that information sharing section that we're adding, and this would set out that expectation, like Deputy Commissioner Lasley said, that the departments would share identifiable health information with each other, or PHI, only to the extent necessary to conduct business between the two departments. And just so you are all aware, both departments are still covered HIPAA entities. Each employee in the department have to go through a yearly HIPAA training. But this change is really important to make sure there is that clear authority to share information. We know we won't always be the same individuals in the leadership seats, and we want to make sure that there's no bureaucratic or administrative barriers to our teams carrying out that work. And a couple of just easy examples of how this happens pretty much on a daily basis. We may have a youth that is in state custody, so an OCS care, that is having an acute psychiatric care at the Alaska Psychiatric Facility, getting discharged, so working with the Medicaid side on community behavioral health services, and also trying to qualify for a home and community-based service waiver. So we often have cases like that where we're coordinating among multiple divisions in the department. And another simple way to think about this is if there's an infectious disease outbreak at the Pioneer Homes or DJJ, we're going to call in the section of epidemiology in the Division of Public Health to help support that outbreak and what needs to happen. I'm going to lump sections 4 to 9 together because overall, all of them are clarifying that the Department of Health is the oversight and licensing agency of programs related to runaway minors. And as we said before, the executive order incorrectly identified the oversight and agency as the Department of Family and Community Services, and these amendments just correct that mistake. Section 10 is amending our central licensing statutes, and it's just clarifying that since the departments each have a piece of these statutes now, that it's important to be really precise and reference which statutes belong to which departments. And Section 10 clarifies that foster care licensing belongs to the Department of Family and Community Services, who is currently performing that work. I'm also going to lump Sections 11 through 15 together because, again, we're in that centralized licensing statutes, but they all make it clear that both departments are involved in the licensing of programs. And the executive order failed to capture all of this nuance, so we're just really being more precise and technical in our language for when people come and do a plain read of the statutes that they know who has authority for which one. And Section 16 provides an immediate effective date.
Thank you. Also on the phone for questions for committee members, we have Steve Williams from the CEO Trust of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We also in the room have the Director of the Civil Division from the Department of Law, Ms. Stacy Crayley is here. And we also have Robert Nave, the Program Manager of Division of Healthcare Services. Are there any questions for the presenter of any of those folks? I do have a question for Mr. Steve Williams for the Alaska Mental Trust Authority on the additional portion of the advisors in Section 2 of this piece of legislation. Mr. Williams, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we can. My question is for, I guess, how often are the advisors attending the board meetings, and how much weight do they carry in terms of their input for the Mental Health Trust Authority?
Through the chair, we try and get the advisors to the trust at our board meetings at least once, if not a couple times a year. It's often a very good dialogue between the commissioners, and generally it's the commissioners and their staff that join these meetings, between the various departments represented and the trustees in terms of the needs of beneficiaries, how we can partner better with the departments and the work that we do.
All right. I guess, Mr. Williams, are they invited to each meeting, or are they invited as board subjects are as needed?
To the chair, they typically are not invited to each meeting, but we do try and bring them in. The board meets 4 times a year, and we try and get them in at least once or twice a year.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to make sure this wasn't adding more of an influence to more of a public board by adding a lot of administrative folks to the board of advisors. So thank you for that. Any further questions?
You're welcome.
All right. Seeing none, we'll open up to public testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau like to testify to Senate Bill 59? Seeing none. And seeing no one online, we will go ahead and close public testimony. We'll go ahead and ask if there's any follow-up statements you guys like to make, any closing statements before we set this bill aside.
No, just thank you for your consideration, and we are around if you do have any follow-up questions.
All right. We will also set an amendment deadline if there's no further questions from committee members for close of business on Monday, March 6th. And thus, that concludes our business today. On Thursday, we will take introduction and take invited and public testimony on Senate Bill 57, Adult Home Care Medical Assistance, which is sponsored by Senate Rules Committee on request of the governor. So we'll see some of you guys back again on Thursday. And we also may consider a CS or a further action on Senate Bill 53, depending if we get that back in time from Legislative Legal. And also, we also may return to Senate Bill 8, repeal certificate need, if we have our changes back from Legislative Legal as well on that date as well. Thus, any further closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 4:37 p.m.